When I was growing up, or I said maybe in high school, I had a youth group leader who was helping us memorize the books of the Bible in order. And I always had trouble with part of the New Testament. And he gave me a little phrase that I've never forgotten all these years later. It's just simply GEP, G-E-P-C, GEP. It stands for Galatians, Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians. So if you get past Romans and 1st and 2nd Corinthians, you have GEP. And that might help you find Galatians. And if it does, good, because we're going to be there for 4 weeks in a row. What's that? Oh, there's another one, General Electric Power Company, but I'm still going to remember GEP. GE Power Company, General Electric Power Company. So Galatians chapter 1 is where we're going to find ourselves this morning. We'll be in the book of Galatians for the course of the next few weeks. Summer school generally carries with it a negative connotation. For some, maybe it means you missed too many classes and you didn't meet the state's mandatory minimum requirement of days in school, so you have to go to summer school to make up those requirements. For others, it means maybe you didn't do so well in one or two classes, so you have to go to summer school to relearn that material and pass a test so that you can advance from the current grade to the next. You make up those classes in summer school. For some, it means maybe you didn't do so well in any of your classes. I do understand there are a few overachievers out there somewhere who simply go to summer school because they want to learn more. They want to learn more than they had time to learn in the semesters of school, and there was a class they wanted to take, didn't have time to take, so they go back to summer school to take it. I talked to one of my friends who told me that his son had to go to summer school last year because he failed his earth science class. He was rather upset when he heard about this, and his son gave him every possible excuse that there is out there. It's the teacher's fault. Dog ate some of my homework. I was sick too many days, whatever it is. And finally, the dad just threw his hands up in the air and says, son, I've heard it all. I don't need to hear anymore. There's only one thing I want to hear from you, and that is why your teacher had something important to teach you and you didn't think it was important enough to learn. Well, while I was thinking about that dad's comment was, I started thinking about how Paul must have wanted to address the Galatian church. He probably felt about the same way. Did that church have an answer for Paul when he asked them that same basic question? This was a rather new body of believers Paul's writing to, and he opens his letter to them in Galatians chapter 1, verse 1, by saying this, I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you to live in the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel, which is really no gospel at all. Evidently, some people are throwing you into confusion and are trying to pervert the gospel of Christ. So what you should know is that not only is Paul frustrated with the Galatians that they have ignored their teacher, but he's especially concerned because he was their teacher. I mean, these are people that Paul knows rather well. He knows them personally because he spent a considerable amount of time with them. And in fact, we learn a little bit about that first encounter Paul had with the Galatians in the book of Acts. The book of Acts tells us this. At Iconium, Paul and Barnabas went, as usual, into the Jewish synagogue. There they spoke so effectively that a great number of Jews and Greeks believed. But the Jews, who refused to believe, stirred up the other Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brothers. So Paul and Barnabas spent considerable time there, speaking boldly for the Lord, who confirmed the message of his grace by enabling them to perform signs and wonders. The people of the city were divided. Some sided with the Jews, others with the apostles. There was a plot afoot among both Gentiles and Jews, together with their leaders, to mistreat them and stone them. But they found out about it and fled to Iconium, cities of Lystra and Derbe, and to the surrounding country, where they continued to preach the gospel. And so from the very first time Paul gets to this Galatian area, he almost immediately sensed the tension between two groups of people, Jews and Gentiles. There were these Jews, and there were those who weren't. So by the time Paul starts planting these churches in southern Galatia, the churches become made up of two various different types of people too, right? On the one hand, they had some Christians who grew up under the tenets of Judaism, and they understood those traditions, and they held to them. And there were new Christians, Gentiles, who weren't Jews, and they didn't even know what these traditions meant. So not long after Paul preaches the gospel to them and he raises up a new group of believers, there were some of these older Jewish Christians going around spreading a message to the Gentile Christians, and they were saying, unless you hold to these Jewish traditions, that your faith isn't enough. They were saying that this newfound faith in Jesus wasn't enough on its own. They told them that true salvation came not only from their faith in Jesus, but also from perfectly obeying all of these other rules. Now, if you've been a follower of Jesus for a while, that sounds not true, and it's not. We don't believe that. But yet, in reality, there are still some Christians who hear this, and they think, man, that kind of sounds like the way I was taught. Because truth is, some of us grew up being taught that our ticket into heaven was primarily based on doing things, maybe strict church attendance. And so the only reason you never missed a church service was that you were terrified about what someone in that church might say if you did. Or maybe you grew up around a group of smug, self-righteous Christians who always seemed to use their Bibles to hurt people instead of help people. And maybe you're sitting here today and you're one of those hurt people. One of those people may have been you, right? There are people who have felt unwelcome and unwanted by a holy group of people who looked, dressed, and acted exactly alike and expected you to do the same. Years ago, I took a youth group to a group of high school students to Florida during the spring break time. And we left Florida for home on a Saturday, spent the night in northern Georgia, and woke up early Sunday morning, and we were going to finish our drive home. About 10:30, I got on Google, and I tried to find a church that had an 11 o'clock service that was nearby so we could worship that morning on the way home. And I found one pretty close to the highway, just randomly selected it, stopped, walked in, and from the moment we walked in, it was painfully obvious that we were in a very formal church. Everyone was dressed in suits, ties and dresses, and we were traveling in shorts and t-shirts and sandals. We walked in this group, there were about a dozen of us, and no one greeted us. Not one person. Not one person came up and said hello. No one came and shook our hand. No one came up and asked who we were. So I kind of got our whole group together, and we decided, hey, we kind of look like outfits here. Let's just sit in the back. We don't want to disrupt anything. So we sat in the back couple rows of the church, and the kids participated in worship just great. They sang the hymns, most of which they had never heard before. They listened to the message, they bowed their heads and were quiet during prayer. And then, at the end of the service, we were just getting up to leave, and an older gentleman who was about five rows in front of us on the other side of the church made eye contact with me, and then he made a beeline toward me. Without introducing himself or getting our names or anything, he just kind of leaned in and said, hey, y'all, just want you to know, if you ever come back here, we dress appropriately when we come to the Lord's house. Now, one of the kids in our group, he was a senior in high school at the time, didn't handle the situation very well. And before I could even respond or say anything, he replied, oh, yes, Lord's house. That's what we were looking for. Do you happen to have an address? Well, here's the thing. The majority of kids who were in our group, you know, we're familiar with the gospel, but that gentleman didn't know that. To be honest with you, I'm not sure that he cared if we did. But to him, all he seemed to know was that a good Christian was supposed to look, dress, and act a certain way, and we didn't match his expectation. And so many of the early Jewish Christians had fallen in love with being religious about Jesus, instead of having a relationship with Jesus. They were fanatical about the way that they thought people should look and feel and act too. And it's what the American church is kind of guilty of sometimes today. We take the greatest story ever told and we add to it. Or we take the greatest news that anyone could ever receive and we try to pile on top of that our own things. We throw in our own personal preferences, our own opinions about what church should look like, our own political agendas, all the things that we've done that make us feel good. And what we do, what we say when we do that is, we start believing what I've done matters just as much as what Jesus has done. And that's just not true. All right, here's a picture. Many of you will recognize the guy on the right as Michael Jordan, probably the greatest basketball player of all time. The guy on the left you might not recognize. His name is Stacey King. He was one of Jordan's teammates during the 1990s Chicago Bulls season. This particular photo was taken on a night when Michael Jordan scored a career-high, amazing 69 points individually against the Cleveland Cavaliers. It was one of the greatest basketball performances of a pro basketball player ever. Later that night in the game, Stacey King was called in off the bench. He wasn't a starter. He was just a bench player. He got called in the game, got fouled, was awarded 2 free throws, and made one of them. So he made a total of 1 point during the game. And after the game, when all the media was assembled in the locker room and interviewing players, they went up to Stacey King to ask him about Michael Jordan's performance that night, to which Stacey King replied, "I'll always remember this evening as the night when Michael Jordan and I combined for a total of 70 points." And you just have to love that confidence, right? I mean, here's the thing. I can appreciate that. But if we're not careful, what you and I can start to do is we can relate our own experiences and our own efforts to Jesus' perfection. I don't know about you, but when I look at what I've done in comparison to what Jesus has done, I haven't even scored a basket. I mean, I just haven't. We haven't worked together to accomplish anything. We haven't combined our efforts to create some sort of greatness. I mean, Jesus Christ has literally done it all. And I can't do anything without him. I can't get up here and preach without him. I can't teach a youth group without him. I can't work the way I should work without him. In fact, about the only thing I can do without him is sin. And I've learned to do that pretty well. That's the contribution I bring to the team, right? That's not a good contribution. So Paul understands that anytime you or I try to add our own goodness to the gospel, is what we're really saying is that the gospel on its own isn't enough and it needs more. What we're saying is that Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection got us most of the way to heaven, but he still needs a little help from us. Steve Bell says it well in a book called A Scandalous Freedom. He writes, "The good news is that Christ frees us from the need to obnoxiously focus on our goodness, our commitment, and our correctness. Religion has made us obsessive almost beyond endurance. Jesus invited us to a dance, and we've turned it into a march of soldiers, always checking to see if we're doing it right and are in step and in line with other soldiers. We know a dance would be more fun, but we believe we must go through hell to get to heaven, so we keep marching." And this is the kind of trap that the Gentiles had so easily fallen into, and it just leaves Paul scratching his head, literally wanting to pull his hair out because he's so frustrated. He's wondering, what happened? He's like, Christ died for you. He wiped the debt clean. He offered himself as a sacrifice for all of your sins. And then someone comes along and fools you into thinking that you need to reach some sort of level of holiness before you can enjoy it. He says to them in verse 8, "But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach a gospel other than the one we preach to you, let them be under God's curse." So he's talking about a serious punishment for a serious offense, because what Paul understands and what he's saying to them is that anytime a new gospel is preached, it has a serious consequence, not just for the one preaching it, but for those who are listening to it. You have to be careful. When someone comes up to you and says, "I just learned something brand new in the Bible, and this book doesn't apply to us anymore," I'd be wary of that. When someone comes up to you and says, I just figured out that the Bible's misquoted when Jesus said whatever he says," I'd be wary of that. Sometimes new gospels can be packaged and sold to us in a number of ways. Sometimes it's pointed out to us in a way that it scares us into believing that even with Jesus, we're not going to make it into heaven. People fear this all the time. And then at other times, it's by seducing us into believing that we're already so special that we can make it into heaven without Jesus. They're both equally bad gospels. And it's one of the most dangerous ideologies in our culture, by the way, that's growing today. It's beautifully crafted into individually crafted ego boosts that sound something like this. You're strong. You're enough. You're perfect just the way you are. You can do it. So we scroll past these social media posts and that are on our timeline, and we like them, and we get excited about them, and we share them, and we say, thank you, universe, that you have finally noticed. And what this self-esteem gospel perhaps has done best is it takes you and I by the hand, and it leads us down this road that says, hey, if I'm really all of these great things, what do I need Jesus for? Now, I don't know about you, but if Satan can get me to think about myself just a little bit more, he has me thinking about Jesus just a little bit less. Whether or not we recognize the formula, it's these types of false gospels that really don't add anything to our lives, but they just slowly subtract over time things about Jesus to the point where all we find our hope and encouragement in is suddenly us. And as hopeless as our world can sometimes be, to make ourselves the only place where we can find hope is really scary. I have a friend who teaches middle school girls, and she said telling them you're perfect just the way you are doesn't make their insecurities go away. I have a friend named Ben who teaches, he's a high school youth group leader for boys. You can do it. Probably isn't going to help those boys avoid temptation, he says. Follow your heart is probably the worst advice that anyone has ever given you or me. And it's still the worst advice you can give a kid today. Let's make something super clear. Anytime we give someone a gospel where they have all the answers, where their truth is the only thing that matters, where they are the hero of their own story, all we're giving them is false hope. We should refuse to give you or your children or anyone else we come in contact with a hope in this world or a hope in anything else other than Jesus. Now, Paul could have been a whole lot lax. He could have been a whole lot calmer about this. He could have just said, hey, watch what you're teaching. Watch what you're listening to. It doesn't sound right. He could have been like, I don't want to be the heavy. I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but. And seriously, Paul could have been a little more passive with the Gentiles, with the Galatians, just like we have the opportunity to be passive with the way we share the gospel today, just like we could be passive with the next generation who are one day going to have to carry this on to the next. But what Paul understood then is what we need to understand now. It's a simple equation that goes like this. A new gospel is no gospel. It needs no addition. It needs no subtraction. Nothing should ever be added. Nothing should ever be taken away. As much as our culture would like to convince you and me that this message of Jesus is far too narrow, far too intolerant to be true, Paul is unapologetically telling the Galatians this. Am I trying to win the approval of human beings or of God? Am I trying to please people? If I were still trying to please people, I wouldn't be a servant of Christ. Now, I know that sounds harsh, but you should know that Jesus was even less apologetic when he said these words, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And so in other words, when we go down this path that says, everything is relevant, so just live your truth, When we go down the path that says, you're enough, the path that says, everything that you need is already in you somewhere, when we go down the path that says, all roads eventually lead to the same place, when we take Jesus out of the equation in that manner that our culture says we should, the answer that we come up with will eventually look like this. Doesn't leave much room for interpretation, does it? And listen to me. The truth of the gospel is not relative. The truth of the gospel is relational. It has more to do with who we know than what we do. And Paul understands that when anytime we take Jesus out of the equation, what we will always end up with is a bigger problem. That bigger problem is eternal separation from God. The problem that the Father sent his one and only Son to solve for good. When we take Jesus out of the equation, we don't have that benefit. Kevin DeYoung put it this way. It's true that every road leads to God, but only one way leads to a pleasant encounter with him. I'm pretty good at math, at least I think I am. I once was subbing in Wald Lake High School, and the principal observed the class and said, hey, would you be willing to teach for a semester while a teacher's on maternity leave? And I did. But trying to help my children with math today, well, with what they've done to math, has made it nearly impossible. Nate Barazzi is a good Christian comedian. He summed up my frustration pretty well. Watch this.
We're doing homework too. Our daughter's starting to bring it all home. Homework's fun. First and second grade was awesome. Third grade, you're like, okay. They throw some stuff in. You're like, oh, all right. It's okay. Learning it earlier than we used to, huh? I don't even know that's true, but she brought home Common Core math. That's fun. It's a new math they invented. No heads up. Just give it to parents that never learned it. It's just a whole new. I mean, it's unbelievable. Why when they bring it home, you got to watch a 40-minute YouTube video on Common Core math. I don't even understand it. If you know it, if you don't know Common Core, it's just a new math. And the goal of Common Core is to use one sheet of paper for every problem. You just want to keep breaking the problem down. You put the problem at the top, and it just keeps going. And then what's even funnier is you see old math in the middle of it. As you break it down, old math gets in there, and you're like, oh, just do that at the top. I don't even know what we're doing. And it's not like old math isn't working. I mean, old math's doing, I don't get incorrect change everywhere just going, this stupid old math. It's a long way to get to the same answer. I told my wife, I go, it feels like if you knocked on my front door and I opened it, and you say, can I come in? And I was like, do you mind walking in and coming in through the back door? And you'd be like, does the front door not work? I'm like, no, it works. I use it. A lot of people still use it. But the new way is to go jump the fence and come in the back and meet me at this same spot.
So if you're the father of a third grader, you can look at the schoolwork thing and say, this is way over my head. I mean, as funny as it is, the reality is that people here today can relate with this. Because if you're the parent of a child of any age, there's a pretty good chance that the problems they are bringing home, no one has taught you how to solve. They're learning things today at an earlier age than you did. I don't just mean math. If I had to guess, you probably have figured out that this world is teaching your children a long and convoluted way to solve their problems. And you pray like crazy that someday they'll end up with the right answer. I've come to the conclusion, instead of trying to have an answer for every single different problem, having a different answer for all of them, probably the best response is to sometimes have one answer that would answer every possible question or problem. Because when we teach our kids who Jesus is and what he's done for us, what he wants to continue to do in us, what he's left behind for us, it's amazing how many problems can be solved with that one answer. Our church, this body of believers must back that up at every level. In the example we set, in the effort we teach, in the way we lead and mentor, in the energy we put into special events and activities, and yes, in the way we reach out to those who don't yet know Jesus. We need parents or people who are willing to give up a week of their summer and go to camp and just be there as a chaperone to mentor and lead and sponsor children, because that might be the only week of the year some kids are ever going to hear about the love of Jesus. We need adults who will participate and take a week to sponsor kids to go to CIY Mix. This is a program for middle school kids that will change their lives forever. But we have to find adults who will take them. We need adults who will take a week off of their life, take a week off work, take a week out of their normal activities, and take kids to CIY Move, a summer conference, because that life or that week could make an eternal difference. I have seen nothing better in my entire life for high school kids than what CIY Move does for them. There's no better presentation of the gospel for high schoolers on a Christ in Youth conference. But we have to have adults who are willing to go and sacrifice a week of their lives so that other kids can go and take advantage of it. I don't have it all figured out yet. 40 years after beginning ministry, I still can't solve all the problems or give all the answers. And I suspect even collectively as a church, a big body of people, many of which have been Christ followers for a very long time, even combined, we probably don't have all the answers, but I know this. Jesus isn't our best guess. He's our only answer. He's it. What he says goes, because what we know is that his love is the only thing that will stand the test of time. So whether you've been a Christian for 50 years or 5 minutes, don't ever lose sight of the gospel message. Don't overcomplicate it. Don't overlook it. God has made an investment in you. He sent his one and only son to die a criminal's death on a cross, to take the burden of sin and shame off of our shoulders. He sent Jesus from heaven to earth to clean up a mess that he didn't make. And the question we can't sometimes wrap our heads around or find an answer to is why? Why did God do that? I'm just going to take a stab at answering that question this morning. Maybe, just maybe, it's because he's a dad. Best dad ever was. And the most important thing a dad can do is make sure their kids make it home safe. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." And a couple thousand years after he said that, the math still checks out. The problem still gets solved, still is, and always will be that Jesus did for you and me what we could never do for ourselves. And the good news is, thanks to what Jesus did, you and I will never have to worry about making it home.